from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the national spotlight on Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey as she challenges President Trump's positions on immigration, climate, and his claims of voter fraud in New Hampshire.
There were no buses. There was no fraud. He lost New Hampshire. And it's frankly beyond pathetic that they keep bringing this up.
That and more in our weekend review. Also today, how the innovation economy is reviving a dying class of jobs.
While we talk about all of this innovation, it's interesting to think about, well, what's happening on the manufacturing side, because in fact, a lot of these companies are going to have to make a product.
Plus, remembering the early days of the AIDS epidemic in Boston.
I got into magical thinking, believing that it was an illness that was in New York and in San Francisco, but it didn't have anything to do with me until it became right in my face.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Our weekend review on this Friday is starting with Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. She's been in the headlines on several issues all week, including immigration.
My heart goes out to our immigrant communities who have experienced tremendous fear and anxiety. The answer is yes, you are safe. I've got your back, your mayor has got your back, and there are people all across the state that have got your back. And the governor has been clear about this as well.
Healey's comments came on the national so-called Day Without Immigrants yesterday. That's when businesses across the country shut down and some people refused to spend money to show how much immigrants contribute to the country. Vanity Fair this week called Healey the threat that President Trump never saw coming. We'll talk about this and more with our panelists this week. Joining us in studio is Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Hello.
Hi, Deb.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Good to see you.
It's good to be with you.
So let's start with this Vanity Fair piece about Attorney General Healey. It suggests that Healey could be one of the most effective adversaries of the president because of some of her legal actions and her outspokenness. And just want to play a little bit of tape here of what Attorney General Healey said at the Boston Women's March on Boston Common last month. Let's listen.
I have a message for President Trump. The message from the people of Massachusetts: we'll see you in court.
That was State Attorney General Maura Healey. Jim Sturgis, I'm wondering, what do you think of Maura Healey's actions here?
Well, you know what? I think that she is being smart politically, and I think that she is being respectful in the way she does it. She said, I'm going to use the institutions against you. We have institutions in this country for a reason. If you disagree with somebody, you use them. What I would also say is, in addition to the courts, especially, for example, as regards the subpoena from the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, which was looking into Maura Healey and also Attorney General Schneiderman in New York, their investigation of folks who have views that may not align on climate change. What's interesting there is a renewal, whether in her office or I think more broadly among people in the Democratic Party, to look at institutions, for example, like federalism, to say, look, we have state sovereignty, of state rights. We can actually exploit these to the full degree. We can push back on your agenda. So I think it's a respectful, a thoughtful way of going at it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, Arlene, what do you think of this and the national attention as well?
Well, I think she's been doing a great job on this. When what Jim was just talking about, her going after, for example, Exxon for accusing them of fraud, for encouraging climate change confusion all these years, when decades ago their scientists had well established the fact that petroleum products and fossil fuel burning contributes to global warming, that it would inevitably end in global temperatures increasing and the dangers that would be there. I love the fact that she's going after them, whether or not they committed fraud for their investors and their customers. You know, to borrow a line from the NRA, who isn't wild about Maura, the best way to stop bad guys with a lot of lawyers is to have a good AG with a lot of lawyers. And if we don't have somebody like her taking on corporations that will be protected by Trump, I don't know who's going to do it for us.
Hmm. Well, as long as we're on the topic of ExxonMobil, she did say, Maura Healey said she's not going to comply with a new subpoena from the Congressional Committee seeking documents in connection with this fight with ExxonMobil. I mean, what do you think of that?
Bully for her. I mean, firstly, most people think that the Congressional Committee doesn't have jurisdiction to intervene in a state investigation to begin with. But on top of that, it's clearly a question of harassment. One of the other members of that very congressional team who knows that the chairman of that committee is a climate change denier, or let's call him a skeptic at best, and other congressmen on that committee are saying that the committee is being used to harass climate scientists and that it's a serious misuse of congressional oversight. So I'm thrilled she's standing up to them. We need her to do that.
Jim Sturgis, what do you think of her not complying with this?
I think she's going to lose that battle pretty clearly. I also would say, look, on investigating Exxon, that's one thing. I think in terms of investigating, let's say, a Richard Lindzen at MIT, who's a very serious climatologist but who disagrees, I find that is chilling. That is chilling to free speech, and I'm big on free speech, so I don't like that very much. On the other side, I'd say it's very hard not to comply with Congress because Congress has the power of inquiry, especially when it relates to something they could legislate on or they have legislated on. So I think her noncompliance will crumble. It will take time. And again, this is how you use the courts as well. And she's trying to gum things up. And our institutions allow for that. So I don't think it's smart politically. I don't think she'll win that battle.
Hmm. Do you think she is positioned as one of the national leaders against President Trump?
I don't think so, no.
No. Arlene?
I don't know that she was positioned previously, but she's becoming so. Hmm. She's clearly going to become, she is and will become even more so, I believe, a loud, strong, very smart voice in opposition to whatever legal opposition we could generate. She'll clearly be on the front line. She's very comfortable doing it. So, and she's smart, she's articulate, she's got good policy positions that are very much different from the president. So I think she has a very good shot at becoming more and more visible.
Hmm. Well, when we talk about visibility and we talk about some of these moves and what they might or might not mean politically, there, of course, have been lots of suggestions, lots of speculation about why she might be doing some of this. And she was floated as a potential gubernatorial candidate. Might she challenge Charlie Baker? But she was asked about this. She spoke with the Globe yesterday, and she insisted that she's going to seek re-election again in 2018. Here she is talking with the Globe's Josh Miller.
Your message to Democrats who are looking for a candidate is find another candidate for governor no matter what. It's not going to be me in 2018. Is that right?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm sure there'll be, and there are already some announced candidates, and, you know, we'll see what that field looks like. But I am focused right now, Josh, I am really focused on the work that we've got to do. And as I say, we've got our hands full right now.
So, Jim Sturgis, what do you think? She's probably not going to seek election as governor in 2018.
In all of these things, like she would be running against a governor who's quite popular. I think she's in wait-and-see mode is my guess, and probably leaning not to do it. I think she's says what she means. I like listening to people when they say stuff. So I believe she's actually not thinking about it actively. But let's say we see a decline in Baker's popularity, and we see that Seti Warren and Jay Gonzalez don't catch fire. Hmm. I think there'll be quite a lot of pressure, and to be courted is a lovely thing in politics.
Hmm. But isn't the reputation in Massachusetts the attorney general never makes it to the governor's office?
That's exactly right.
That's right. That's in the history. It's a strange and interesting history.
So is there another office that might be more suitable? Arlene, any thoughts
sure she,
on that?
I doubt very much that she'll be running for governor, both for the reasons that Jim mentioned the historical point that you just made. But I'm sure. But she will certainly.
Hey, the Red Sox did it, right?
True that. I think she's going to be well positioned for a number of higher office possibilities in the future when we see which seats become free, and she will. I think play an increasingly large role statewide and nationally as well.
Okay, so let's talk about immigration as well, because this was another big issue in the news and everywhere else. With Attorney General Healey and, of course, nationally, I'm wondering, first off, let's just talk about the Day Without Immigrants yesterday here in Massachusetts and the continuing fight here. Who's a sanctuary city? What's happening? I mean, how do you think we're going to see this issue play out, particularly with political candidates? Jim?
So let me go to the issue first. I think the issue is that at the end of the day, the federal government has a lot of money that it gives to cities and can use that as a lever that will be for some punishing. New York City, you can't imagine what they would do if they lost $10.4 billion, which is what they get from the federal government. Not all of that, I think. An executive action by Trump could actually stop. There's a lot of that money that would have to flow anyways. But it is a concern whether it's you're the mayor of Somerville and you're trying to think this through. There is a big risk there, and especially with someone who's really creates a lot of uncertainty. President Trump is, by definition, he walks into a room, there's a lot of uncertainty. You don't know what he's going to do next. So it is a big risk. I would say this state is a state that supports immigrants, and that includes undocumented, illegal, however you want to call that, immigrants. We are welcoming, I think, the idea that, for example, there was a proposal that was floated perhaps from within the Homeland Security Department. They were thinking about calling up 100,000 National Guardsmen. We're not sure if that's a White House position. I think it's they said no. That's something that Massachusetts folks
would... I think they said it was an original part of a proposal, but it is no longer considered part of a proposal. So,
That's something that doesn't fly here.
Right. And we should actually say that Governor Baker issued a statement about that, saying that he is against the use of National Guard troops, and it wouldn't affect Massachusetts either. And so it's obviously a big issue. You know, we had a lot of protests at Logan Airport when the president's executive order came out. We've got a lot of very strong feelings about that. A lot of people in this state anxious. We've been reporting on folks who are very anxious about this. I'm just wondering, we're not in a bubble here. Are there political leaders who you think will take a different position here than what the majority might do?
You know, we're seeing two different kinds of reactions. We're seeing actually three. On the one hand, we're seeing the legal actions, you know, the ACLU lawyers who were at the airport, at Logan Airport, when Trump announced the travel ban, and they were up there till the wee hours of the morning in courts fighting it. Then Attorney General Healey joined in and have made a marked difference in the way the legal course that has happened since then. But we're sort of seeing three things happening. That's the legal piece. Then within the political realm, you've got the philosophy of values, and then you've got the practicality of day-to-day reality. And the philosophy is that, as Jim said, we're a welcoming state. And that's clearly broadly felt among many in our state, perhaps even, I would say, most. Then there's the reality that the reason that you'll see Chelsea and Lawrence filing suit against Trump's executive orders on this, and the reason that they want sanctuary cities to be protected and their police want sanctuary cities to be protected is because the reality on the ground is, for law enforcement purposes, they need sanctuary city protections. They need immigrant communities to trust the police. They need immigrant communities to report crimes, to not be afraid of reporting crimes. And that will, and were they to lose the sanctuary city status, that would most assuredly happen. And they're aware of that. So whether you do it for values reasons and philosophy, or you do it for the terra firma, we need the police to be effective. It's compelling in this state.
The president's promising a new executive action on immigration next week, based on lessons learned from court fights on the first one. So I think this is going to continue. And I'm not sure, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you have any thoughts, any predictions on what we might expect from here?
Sure. Deb, I think maybe one useful way to think about this is right now, the original line, if you will, the line of thinking by the Trump administration has not been embraced by really any state leader or regional leader in Massachusetts, with the exception of Sheriff Hodgson. Mm-hmm. I don't think that will change.
He, of course, offered folks to help build
the
wall.
Mm-hmm. But what I would say is Trump's MO is to move goalposts, to say something outrageous and keep pushing it, until what seems outrageous in the discourse becomes the outer edge, and he can push for certain things. And I think once that happens, you will see a more, perhaps a more moderate proposal, and you will see some political leaders accept that on the basis of rule of law. I don't think it'll be any big thing here in Massachusetts, but I think that we'll have much bigger ramifications on the southern border.
So let's move on. I want to talk about some other issues. Another topic, really, with local implications here, a national topic with local implications, and these are the unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud in New Hampshire. President Trump said that he would have won New Hampshire if not for the, quote, thousands of people who were brought in on buses from Massachusetts to vote illegally. This debate renewed when on ABC's This Week, George Stephanopoulos pressed Stephen Miller, Trump advisor, and let's listen to what Miller said.
Go to New Hampshire, talk to anybody who's worked in politics there for a long time. Everybody's aware of the problem in New Hampshire with respect to
I'm asking you as the White House senior I'm asking you as the White House senior policy advisor. The president made a statement saying he was the victim of voter fraud, people
and
being bused from Massachusetts
to New Hampshire. The president was.
Do you have any evidence?
Oh, okay. So there we go. Do you have any evidence? There was no evidence cited. But again, this is something that has come up several times here in terms of voter fraud allegations in New Hampshire. I'm wondering, Arlene, what do you think? Why do we continue to hear this from the Trump administration about the vote count in New Hampshire?
You know, this bears a striking resemblance to Trump's assertions that at 9/11 he saw thousands of Muslims cheering in New Jersey. And not only did he not see it, but he didn't see it because it didn't happen. So there is not a shred of evidence that his assertion about voter fraud in New Hampshire, or really elsewhere, to be quite honest, is true. And what we're seeing now are he has a campaign official, his campaign folks are saying it, but the New Hampshire Secretary of State is calling the allegations false. And more interestingly, A lot of prominent Republicans in New Hampshire are all saying it's an absurd accusation, whether it's Steve Dupre, a former state Republican state committee chair, or Tom Rath, a former state attorney general, or Fergus Cullen, a former state Republican attorney state chairman. They're all saying it didn't happen. So the question is, if you look at it, the governor ship was won by a Republican. If there were thousands of people, and other seats were run by Republicans, if thousands of Massachusetts voters were illegally going to New Hampshire to vote, they would have voted Democrat across the board, and Sununu would not be the governor right now.
Well, you know, you speak about there were many, many prominent folks who have completely debunked this theory, but there are some who have not. We, on Radio Boston, spoke with former New Hampshire State Rep Stephen Stepanek. He was co-chair of Trump's campaign there. And he told us that he takes issue with the same-day voter registration requirements in New Hampshire and other things. Let's listen.
I've coined the phrase, if you're in the New Hampshire state of mind, you can come up to New Hampshire and vote. And essentially what that means is you have to just state that you feel that you want to live in New Hampshire and have a domicile for a day, and you can vote in New Hampshire.
Okay. Jim Sturgis, what do you think of those comments from the co-chair of Donald Trump's presidential campaign in New Hampshire?
Look, my view is there is illegal voting going on. We used to have a good amount of it with Tammany Hall and all the urban legends around the 1960 JFK election. We haven't grown angel's wings since then, not that I've noticed. But if you follow the data suggests that if there are issues, they're rather infinitesimal. Now, there isn't much evidence, whether it's the Pew Research that the President Trump cites or other research that he cited across time. There's a guy named Jesse Richmond that he cited frequently. Jesse himself says he doesn't feel like his research is being used appropriately.
Right.
And even if you took Jesse Richmond's research and you went to the outer edge of the number of votes that could have been impacted in the last presidential election, he said it couldn't go beyond 800,000. So we
across
are
the country.
Across the country. You originally asked, what are they up to? And I would say what President Trump is trying to do is to create a narrative that he can build upon. And that narrative would lead to a Department of Justice investigation of voter fraud. Is it happening? What do the roles look like? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I, in principle, have no issue with data or doing an investigation. The problem is, whatever comes out of any kind of investigation, if you find a small bit of illegal voting, okay, what do you do about it? And does it chill the participation of folks who would be scared to actually go there anymore. So this is one where it drives me crazy, because we could have a reasonable conversation and we could ferret out the 0.something% legal votes, and we could make some changes that we might need to make. Okay, got it. Because we want to preserve the franchise. It could lead to some messy stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think Jim makes a very good point. There is inevitably some degree of voter fraud that might be taking place, but it is likely infinitesimal. One of the ironies of Trump's assertion is that the one place where we know for sure people have claimed residence in a different state, even though they were registered in two states, were the Trump family and allies, his kids, you know, people on his campaign staff who several months ago, there were big headlines about the fact that they were registered in one state and they voted in a different state. So it does exist, but I don't think it's determinative of the outcome.
Right. Well, I think it's all about his election victory to a certain degree, which was among the topics at a very wide-ranging press conference yesterday that the president held that lasted for more than an hour, was called only about an hour or two before it was scheduled to start. And among the things that the president talked about, of course, was Russia, because that has been a lot in the news lately. And he was asked about reports that his staff was in touch with the Russians during his campaign, and President Trump said nobody that he knew of spoke with Russian intelligence. Let's listen.
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question, so important. Russia is a ruse. I have nothing to do with Russia. Haven't made a phone call to Russia in years. Don't speak to people from Russia. Not that I wouldn't, I just have nobody to speak to.
So that was President Trump talking about Russia and reports about his campaign staff being in touch with Russia. So I'm just wondering, what strikes you from those comments about Russia, Jim Sturgis, and also just about the press conference in general? What kind of stood out for you?
Nothing stood out that was abnormal from what we'd seen in the campaign. It was sprawling, unwieldy. He enjoyed the hell out of it. He called out people rightly,
wrongly.
He wasn't
ranting and raving so much. He enjoyed it, apparently, yeah.
The key word seemed to me, nobody that I know of. We know that the FBI was at least, I don't want to say investigating, but they were sort of tracking the communications of Paul Manafort, of Mike Flynn, of a couple of other folks that were working on the campaign. This is one where I think Congress, even Republicans who may be concerned with the temperament of the president, may look to use an investigation to tether him to the ground so he actually starts behaving a little bit. I don't think that'll work, but I think we're in for some investigation at some point. It's not going to happen soon, but this is not going to die down for months.
You know, one of the things that I find striking is that they say that the Justice Department warned the White House last month about Flynn's conversations with Moscow and the possibility that he might be vulnerable to blackmail from Moscow. Mm. So Trump and his administration has known for a month about Flynn, and yet nothing happened. He did not fire him until just the other day for supposedly lying to Pence. The question is, did he lie to Trump? Well, Trump, he can't, whether he did or not, Trump has known for a month that it was a lie if he did. So Trump has known the truth and took no action. That's bad management by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, another thing I just want to make sure that we get in here before that we talk about a little bit before we go is also about the president's attacks on the media. I'm, of course, particularly interested in this, but he again, when he was asked about his now resigned national security advisor, Michael Flynn, he talked about leaks to the media about what Mr. Flynn may or may not have said to the folks in Russia. And, of course, he said that this was based on information that was leaked to the media. Let's listen to this bit of what the president had to say.
Well, the leaks are real. You're the one that wrote about them and reported them. I mean, the leaks are real. You know what they said. You saw it. And the leaks are absolutely real. The news is fake because so much of the news is fake.
So I'm just wondering, I mean, is this truly a campaign on the part of Trump to discredit journalists who might be his critics?
Absolutely. You know, Trump does not let the facts get in the way of his opinions, unfortunately,
but
in too many instances.
But that's how he's been across the board.
Yes, mm-hmm. It has been. Yeah. That has been the case. And he also has, as a result, a sort of Orwellian approach to communicating, which is if you keep saying something, even when you know it's not accurate, some people will believe it, and then that will grow to more people who will believe it. And he rather brilliantly takes his opponent's words and then makes them his own weapons. So fake news, where did that come from? It was a tool used against the Clinton campaign, like the Pizzagate issue, right? But who ends up using fake news now? Trump. The very thing his people are accused of doing, he now uses as a weapon against the media.
Thoughts, Jim?
Look, one thing I'm fearful of with President Trump is that there's a big game going on here within the EPA, within the Department of Justice, the intelligence services, and the media. He has this perception that everyone's kind of arrayed against him. The leaks and going to the media back and forth reinforce that view. Things like paranoia set into situations like that. And you'll remember that Richard Nixon, at the very end of his administration, was like him and three people sitting in his office. And I think one of the things he's going to try to do is to get out and do a lot of rallies because he wants to get the heck out of Dodge for a little bit, kind of clear his head, one hopes. We'll see how it goes out. This relationship will not get any better. And the idea of actually incorporating many other different media voices, some of which are very non-traditional, is his way of saying that everyone is going to be treated on an equal footing. No one's given more prestige than another. He'll be playing that game for the entire term.
All right. Well, we are out of time, so I want to thank both of you for going over some of the news of the week, and we have so much more that we didn't even get to, but thanks anyway. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you.
It's great to see you.
Arlene Isaacson, Co-Chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus.
Great to
thanks.
Be here.
Okay. Stay with us. Coming up, the new face of manufacturing in Massachusetts. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The first shared robotics workspace in the country opened in Boston's Seaport District today. It's called Mass Robotics, and it allows emerging companies to share equipment to try to keep up with the latest technologies. The workspace's executive director, Tom Ryden, says he wants to help companies stay and grow here.
Massachusetts has one of the strongest robotics community of anywhere in the world. And there's probably around 150 or so companies generating a couple of billion dollars worth of revenue on technology being developed right here in Massachusetts.
A recent report from the Massachusetts Technology Collaborative says the innovation sector, which includes biotech, software, and electronics, created more than $200 billion in economic activity in 2014. And some say the field may be reviving manufacturing to some extent. Elizabeth Reynolds is the executive director of the MIT Industrial Performance Center. She says many of the jobs of the future will be in advanced manufacturing, combining information technology with advanced machinery. She's written about this for the Boston Globe, and she joins us to talk more about it. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deb.
So let's start. What is advanced manufacturing?
Well, it's an interesting time where we've had a lot of development in IT, right? That would be cloud storage, big data, high-speed computing, and we're combining it with advances in machinery, so robotics, which you just mentioned, as well as sensors. And when we put these together, along with new materials and new processes, nanoscale manufacturing, et cetera, we see an enormous amount of opportunity for manufacturing. We see a complete change in the way we've made things before. We used to have a sort of linear process. Inputs go in, product comes out. Now we have a much more integrated feedback loop in which machines are talking to each other, they're talking to the cloud, factories are talking to each other. It's a very exciting time. Hmm.
And so what kinds of jobs do you think might come out of that then in terms of manufacturing or advanced manufacturing jobs?
Well, what we see, it really affects a lot of different industries. So you name it. In this region, we see aerospace, defense, biopharmaceuticals, medical device, and all of these places, what's changing is that manufacturing jobs now will have much more of a data component to them. So in the past, where we were largely just using machinery to make equipment, now we see data through sensors being used in all sorts of ways, so that the jobs that people have will perhaps be still technicians' jobs, but they'll have to figure out how to be using computer skills. They'll have to have some data analytics. And that will happen, I think, in every area that we see new manufacturing coming online.
In your article, you go through some examples of Massachusetts companies actually doing this. Can you talk about some of those?
Yes. I think like others, I have felt a certain anxiety. We talk about the future of work and people are constantly talking about automation and what's going to be around in the future, are robotics taking our jobs. And so for me, it's really important to look on the ground and see, well, what's going on? What do we understand about firms and industries today? And what I found in three cases was significant investments by firms in manufacturing in the region. And we're a high-wage, high-cost region. So the question was, well, why are they doing this, right? So in the three cases I looked at, one is electronics manufacturing. You know, here we are, a Dutch company looking to open up its first U.S. manufacturing facility, and it chooses Massachusetts. And it chooses it because we are innovative, because we have talent, and because it also has the capabilities through its automation, through its robotics and software capabilities, to invest in this kind of place and create at this point at least 150 jobs.
But then are you saying then that you have to pay higher wages to people? So are we not talking about sort of the manufacturing jobs of old? We're talking about skilled, sort of higher paid types
of
jobs.
That's right. In fact, the skill sort of bar, if you will, is getting higher, and it's getting higher across the board. What I found in the case I just mentioned and in biopharmaceuticals as well as in clean energy is that two-thirds of the jobs that they will be creating, new jobs for the region, will require at least a four-year degree. So we're looking at college-educated workers coming into these manufacturing facilities. Importantly, one-third do not and will be, you know, two-year degree holders. And I think it's important for us to realize that what I heard from some of these CEOs, that more important than the degree is really the mindset of the worker. So what I heard people asking was, workers of the future have to be curious. Are they curious? Are they able to use their judgment? Are they engaged in continuous learning? Are they flexible? And that's the kind of workforce we're going to need for these jobs.
You know, it's interesting. There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal about so-called soft skills, right? And many employers saying they cannot find enough workers who have critical thinking, good communication skills, can be a team player, can get along well with others. And that is really what's hampering the workforce. I mean, is there something in what you're saying, and maybe you don't know this, you know, because you haven't looked at it, but is there something also about Massachusetts where maybe we have workers who are good at soft skills that might be able to work in this, you know, advanced manufacturing kind of thing? Or what do you think about that?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that we've had, on the whole, we have a very highly skilled workforce. And what's been really impressive about the Massachusetts economy has been the transitions through business cycles, you know, the ups and downs through transitions technologically, where the workforce has adapted and where we have had skills sort of transition from one field to another. And I think, you know, we obviously have a very strong educational background here or system. What we know to be true going forward is not only are those soft skills important, but also we're going to have to be introducing more of the computer-related skills and STEM-related. So really, from kindergarten through 12th grade.
That's what I was going to ask. How early do we start introducing these?
In fact, they're already doing this in some states. But where we, everybody at an early age knows what coding is and wants to become a coder. I mean, this is the kind of mentality we have to start to introduce in the next generation.
So you're not saying change vocational education or anything like that necessarily. You're saying, you know, make sure that we're all aware from a very early age.
Well, we're all going to have to figure out how to work in the digital workplace, across the board. But in fact, I think vocational and community college education is critically important for helping with this kind of education and with preparing the workforce for these jobs going forward. So I think we are doing a good job focusing on those and trying to particularly connect them to the firms and to industry, thinking about apprenticeships, thinking about ways in which we can start to integrate work experience with education for these workers of the future.
You know, you started out by saying your concerns about automation, and we know that jobs have been lost because of automation. What do the numbers suggest about that, and what do the future projections look like?
Well, that is, I think that we certainly know that we have lost what we call middle-skill jobs in our economy, that jobs that have are more prone to routinization or have, identified patterns are more easily automated, and artificial intelligence can read things more easily and more quickly than you and I can. So we have seen the shrinking of the middle skill jobs and the middle class because of that. I think going forward, there is a sense that we will continue to see some of this substitution automation for these jobs. At the same time, I think we also see opportunities for complementarity. So that, in fact, automation will be a way in which it'll enhance a lot of our work and enhance the ways in productivity of our workers. And I think, it's hard to say what the scale will be. There's really estimations that go from, 20% to 50% of jobs and across at least, 30% across a lot of different industries. But I think we can't really imagine what the possibilities are in terms of the growth and the productivity and the outputs. I mean, I think when we think about these new products and services that are going to be hybrid and, a hybrid of sort of hardware and software, it's truly astounding. So I'm hesitant to put any specific numbers on this.
And in the last minute we have, I want to ask you this question. So I know that's going to be challenging. Okay. But how do you think your ideas fit in with President Trump's ideas about manufacturing and bringing back manufacturing jobs?
Okay. Well, I'm thrilled that we're talking about manufacturing in the country. I think that's positive, and I think we've never had a better time to think about the opportunities in this country. I disagree with the idea that we're going to bring back jobs through threatening companies. I think we're going to have to grow them here using our innovation, using our talented workforce.
All right. Elizabeth Reynolds, Executive Director of the MIT Industrial Performance Center and a lecturer on innovation and economic development in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning. Thank you, and thanks for answering that in less than a minute.
Thanks, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, a memoir of love and loss in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Back in 1981, NPR aired a report by Lori Garrett about a mysterious disease, some called it a cancer, that was striking young gay men across the country.
In the last 3 months, 28 cases of Kaposi's sarcoma have been reported in this country, all occurring among gay men, most of them young. Every man suffering from Kaposi's sarcoma also has an unusual viral infection. It's called cytomegalovirus, and it may be connected to this puzzling new cancer outbreak.
Of course, we know now that puzzling cancer was AIDS, and the disease went on to claim the lives of some 34 million people. 1981 also was the year that Michael Ward met Mark Halberstadt. They fell in love, and after 3 years together, Mark was diagnosed and became one of the earliest clients of Boston's AIDS Action Committee. Michael Ward wrote about this in his memoir, The Sea is Quiet Tonight. When we spoke with him a few months ago, he started by describing how he met Mark on Fire Island.
There was just something about him. He was small and wiry and very self-contained, which is, I'm much more extroverted. And there was something very appealing about that, and he very cleverly moved me out of the crowd and out for a walk, and it went on from there.
Mm. And how old were you then?
I was 37, and he was 39.
And what was sort of the atmosphere like then? Describe what it was like to be a 30-something gay man and at that time, It certainly was very different.
It was very different. 81 was so different. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest with a lot of homophobia, and I got involved in New York in the gay rights movement. And we fought very hard for what we felt were our rights. And that also liberation translated into sexual and excessive behavior, let me say. Mm-hmm. And I had been in one relationship for 4 years, which had ended not bitterly, but ended. And I was still, I'm a relationship kind of guy. I mean, I was still looking for the right man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the time, would you say that, it was openly hostile? I mean, what was the environment like? And there are a lot of people who may not remember what it was like in 1981.
There was a lot of homophobia. When I moved to Boston in 79 from Princeton, I was assaulted the first weekend that I was in Boston on the street. I was walking down the street with my former partner who had helped me move, and I had my hand on his shoulder, and a guy stopped his car and got out and came out swinging. And I stepped in front of Frank to block him, and he broke my glasses. And I was just shocked. I mean, I'd never experienced anything like that before.
Oh, my God.
Boston was full. I was spit on in those early years. People threw beer bottles. If we'd be waiting in line to go into a bar, they'd throw beer bottles. There was a lot of overt, hostile, abusive behavior.
And that was here, which here was considered, not, you know, certainly we're not talking, you know, some backwater place.
It wasn't Little Rock. It was Boston.
Right. So I can't imagine then what it was like to have to deal with AIDS at the time. So that this is all coming into the awareness at the time. And you're, what were you thinking?
Well, I thought it belonged somewhere else. Really?
What do you mean? Like another country?
Preferably another planet. Yes. But the stories that we heard were about New York and Boston. Mark was from New York, and so he moved up here to live with me. And he knew people. The first people we knew who got sick were, one was a business partner of his. But we didn't know what it was. It was just, oh my God, Boyd got sick and died in 2 months. And it was bizarre. But when the numbers started mounting up, it became very creepy.
I'm wondering if you could read a passage from your book for us. It's when you and Mark are discussing the possibility that he might have this new disease called AIDS that was sort of in the, that you wished was on another planet.
Yes, yes. So this, in the book, this is just before he was actually diagnosed. He said, "I worry about AIDS." It was the first time he had ever used that word in relation to himself. I could hardly breathe. We can't be having this conversation, I thought. We were lying naked facing each other, and I held his gaze, pushing my panic down. From what I've read, if you had it, you'd know it. None of your symptoms are extraordinary. I know, but this cough isn't going away. My breathing is affected. Maybe it's time to see a specialist. I'm going to call Cesar at his office this afternoon and ask him to get me a referral. Throughout his narration, Mark's voice was without emotion, whether for his own sake or mine, I didn't know. Good idea. Maybe he'll reassure you. I just don't think your symptoms are bad enough. But the black cloud that I'd felt hovering before felt terribly close. We still didn't know anyone personally in Boston with AIDS, but we knew from friends that there had to be 50 or 60 men already diagnosed. The next morning, running too fast along the dirt path on the Cambridge side of the river, I stumbled and nearly fell. I sat down in the grass, panting like a dog. He's not afraid he's going to get AIDS, Mike. He's afraid he already has it. I was soaked with sweat. Oh, dear God, what if he really is sick? I had tried to avoid reading the New York Native articles, believing that they didn't have anything to do with me. Could I really have been blind all these months? Feeling unsteady, I got up and slowly walked back home.
Wow. Very powerful. So was that, would you say that those were common emotions at the time? A lot of denial.
Oh, yes. People
just didn't believe it was. So when you heard these stories about this weird cancer and you saw people that you knew were dying, it still was easy to put it away somewhere. It wasn't going to happen to me. Is that what you were thinking?
It wasn't going to happen to me. And I know this sounds bizarre, but it wasn't going to happen in Boston, even though I had heard stories about people being diagnosed in Boston. The whole thing, I mean, think of an epidemic now starting with a few people and then a few hundred people, and then a few thousand people across the country. And you'd think, oh, this is just, you know, whatever it is, they'll figure it out.
Right. Yeah, he was obviously eventually diagnosed.
Yes.
And you write about visiting him, where you had to go into a room completely, dressed in almost protective gear, if you will. What was that like?
Very, very creepy. The worst thing, the worst part about it for me was that he was so distressed when we would come in wearing gowns, masks, covers on our head, gloves, and he couldn't tell one person from another. He said he felt like a leper.
Oh, boy. So what kind of support did you find here in Boston at the time?
Miraculously, in terms of timing, Larry Kessler had just started the AIDS Action Committee when Mark was diagnosed. And also, Dr. Jerome Groopman had just moved here from Los Angeles, and he was totally on top of what little anybody knew. So we had very good support from organizations that were just beginning to pull themselves together.
How did the AIDS Action Committee support you then? Is it correct in this number here, Mark, was the 100th
person in Massachusetts to be diagnosed.
Okay. And so what kind of support did you get from this fledgling agency known as the AIDS Action Committee
right.
in the 80s, right?
Well, Larry showed up at the hospital, and which he did with every person who was diagnosed, and asked, what kind of support do you have? Do you need help at home? As the organization got more organized and more developed, you know, they ended up having hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. And but Mark was the first in all of it. He was in the very first People with AIDS group. He was the first person to be on the Mayor's Council on AIDS.
And how long did Mark live from the time of diagnosis until the time he passed?
10 months.
Yeah, so it was very fast.
Very fast. In a certain way, it felt like 100 years because we were really in the day, every day. And every day we believed that they were going to find a cure until the last month or so.
What about you? Were you concerned for your own health because of this?
I think denial is a very powerful defense in my psychological system. And I felt like I didn't have time. I was so worried about him, and there were so many things he was unable to do that I was sort of creating a life for both of us while he was sick. And as he got sicker, it took more and more energy.
Mm. At one point in the book, though, you said you did get a positive return.
I did.
An HIV test.
Yeah.
What happened there, and how did you feel?
I was in the first study group that Robert Gallo did in Washington for it was then called HTLV-3 virus. And when I got the test back, I wasn't distraught. I mean, it's very strange. When Dr. Groopman told me with Mark, and I thought he was coming in to say they had found another drug to keep Mark alive. So when he told me that the news he had was that I was not positive, I was negative, I felt disappointed. I thought it was going to be something else. And then I really, you know, I worried about it occasionally, but I was very busy with him. And then right before Mark died, we found out that the test had been a false positive.
You know, your relationship with Mark, as you write, was tumultuous.
Oh, it was.
How do you think his illness affected that? Would it make you almost closer?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, it was a godsend that we had gone into couples therapy and got some really good help in sorting out the difference between someone who is extremely extroverted and somebody who's extremely introverted. And we were very allied by the time he got his diagnosis. So I never once thought about leaving.
Why write this book now, all these years later?
I needed to write it. I retired 3 years ago, and for all the years, he's been dead almost 33 years now. And that scene in the preface of going to call his parents in the waiting room was in my mind from the day it happened, in terms of, if I ever write about this, that's where I'm going to start. So when I stopped working, it was cathartic for me to go. I had never reread my journals from those years. And I went back and reread everything and did a substantial amount of crying. And then began to put it together and thought, I can do this. I can write a book.
Right. But what about the story? What do you hope the story does for people
now?
Because it's a very different time right now.
It's a very different time now.
So do you want to tell them what did AIDS teach the world, or what was it like, or what?
I think more what was it like, for a couple of reasons. The feedback that I've gotten from people who worked in the epidemic, like Larry Kessler and Peter Lombardi, who ran the Buddy program, is that they had, like me, they had so much affect, depressed and undigested from the epidemic, that they cried all through the book. And I think a lot of the survivors who were also caretakers are responding in a very emotional way. But I'm also really interested in young people reading it, because the numbers for adolescents are up 26% for HIV infection.
Oh, really?
Two adolescents a day are being diagnosed in the United States with HIV. Because they believe that now that they know that there are medications you can take, they say, well, I can just take medication. But they don't understand that they're then subject to a lot of other illnesses, and they'll be affected their whole lives.
Okay. Michael Ward, retired psychotherapist, author of the new memoir, The Sea is Quiet Tonight. There's more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for today and for this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend, and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.